In 1975, two women in their 30s got together in Melbourne and started a publishing house. One was a rich kid with a job in advertising, and the other a superb editor. It was a revolutionary moment. Two Australian women taking on the British boys who in those days ruled Australian publishing. Hilary McPhee and Di Gribble were good, very, very good, and their house was a roaring success. The writers McPhee Gribble signed in the 70s and 80s reshaped the literary life of this country, then and still now. Penguin swallowed McPhee Gribble in 1989, but the splendour of that independent publishing house founded 50 years ago has never faded. To look back to that time, Hilary McPhee joins us from Melbourne. Hilary, g'day.
Hello, David. What a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Oh, I've got the editor's tick. Thank you.
You have.
How was it that in the middle of the 1970s that you and Di Gribble came up with the idea that you'd do it yourselves, that you'd be publishers?
We really just wanted to work together. We'd done a little magazine for one of the women's movement things, and we loved doing that. And we just didn't really care what we did as long as we could work together. This was feminism, you know. It was more a matter of finding a good idea to work with. I'd been working in publishing and Di had been in advertising, as you said. So somehow, look, packaging began. I don't know whether you remember packaging. It's when people did big illustrated books and farmed out the design and editing to packages. It was Rainbird came up with the idea in England, I think, and there were books that you could charge a fair amount of money for. So I just spoke to a couple of publishers and they agreed to give us things to package. And as a result of that, we went out and borrowed some money from Di's father. He gave us $3,000, which
was a lot of money.
But we signed a partnership agreement. That was what was peculiar to us. We wanted to be true and honest to each other at all times. It was not a corporate agreement. It was a partnership agreement. So we were very idealistic. And with our $3,000, we went out and bought a white Olivetti golf ball typewriter. They were the latest things. And golf ball typewriters let you change fonts.
And you just slipped the little ball out and in went Calibri Bold.
Absolutely. We were very into typography and it was a divine thing to have to be able to change type and design things. And we could do a lot in that little on that typewriter. We had two white chairs, a bottle of whiskey and a white typewriter. That's all we had. And we started packaging books and it went from there. We got an incredible amount of publicity just by starting because women hadn't done this before.
So you were seen at the time as invaders? Were you? Was it heroic?
People took a rather glamorous view of us because we had this white, swish white office, and two women working together and with. You know, we were idealistic, we were feminist, it was 1975, you know, it was a great time to start. Optimism was in the air hugely and we were totally optimistic. And then came up with a fantastic idea of books for children, which was not being packaged at all. We were packaging them for Penguin. Puffin in England had only ever taken about three Australian novels for children, Ivan Southall and people like that. They rather looked down on Australian stuff. But we came up with this idea for practical books for kids. Look, they'd go so well now. Kids who wanted to do things for themselves without parental permission. So we made sure they were safe and imaginative and things that kids would choose to do without having to ask their parents' permission. I mean, they probably did ask their parents. Their parents probably bought the books, but we made Penguin only charge $1 a copy. We were so idealistic, we thought the kids would buy them with their pocket money. It was that sort of era. There were no reprimands. There were no be careful, do this, ask your parents if you can. Words like scary and fun and exciting were forbidden.
Now, Hilary, what's wrong with scary fun and exciting?
Because it's adults telling kids that things are scary. We wanted kids to find things out for themselves. That was the point. That we wanted them to do things for themselves, like change tires on bicycles. We did that in the office. We tested everything. We had kids in the office during school holidays trying everything out. And then we went around some of the local schools and tried things out on kids so we could see how they reacted to the illustrations that we'd commissioned from a terrific advertising illustrator called David Lancashire, who got very involved. In the end, we did about 21 of these little books. And they went on selling worldwide. Puffin did the sold rights, of course, into Europe. They nearly got into Africa, we heard, but they were certainly right through Europe. And we got about $3 million for those books in the end.
Kept you afloat.
Which kept us very much afloat. We got so little money for everything else we did. I still get PLR for them. It's what for?
Oh, do you?
Yeah,
and for Practical Puffins.
Yes, for a couple of titles that are still alive and kicking. So I would so love somebody out there to say, let's do another version.
But then one day, a young woman bicycled up to the office with a couple of copies of a manuscript that she'd been working on. Which kind of changed things? Who was the young woman?
This was Glenn Tomasetti, who was a folk singer, and she'd written a novel called Thoroughly Decent People about the 1930s. She was a historian as well. It was a very well-researched novel and a terrific novel. And we said, Glenn, we're not doing fiction. We're only doing these children's books. Go away. But she'd heard me launch Kate Jennings' collection of feminist poetry called Mother, I'm Rooted, which was a fantastic collection. And Glenn thought she wanted us to publish her. And she said, as people did in those days, I'll ride my bike round the block 3 times and then I'll come back and you'll tell me what you've decided. So Di and I flicked through this manuscript and looked at each other and said, let's do it.
So that was novel number one.
That was novel number one.
So yep. you had a few novels under your belt
yes.
before another young woman.
With a bicycle.
With
again.
A bicycle. Again with a bicycle. It seems to be a common theme of your work, bicycle tires, authors on bicycles.
In those days you had to give publishers 2 copies. Of the manuscript. And so they sat in people's bike baskets and the women trundled round to us. We were in a bunker by this stage. It was the beginning of our second year when Helen Garner showed up with Monkey Grip. And she said, I think I might have written a novel. Will you read it and tell me if I have? And we, of course, went home that night, both of us with a copy each, and came in the next day and said, we've got to do this. We've got to do this. It's
but now,
about
Hilary,
a world we knew about. Really.
Hilary, this is a chance for us to just speak quietly amongst ourselves on this point. How much editing did Helen's work require?
It required a bit, David, because it was based very much on her journals. It was obviously based on her journals, but it didn't. We didn't restructure it. We let it be what it was. And fiddled a bit and discussed. We only edited in those days in pencil because we thought the author should be allowed to rub it out. And Helen came in the next week and we sat her down and said what we thought was probably me sitting her down because I was the one more doing the editing at that point and saying that we really want to do it, but you do need to make a few changes. I think probably later, years later, we would have recommended a lot more changes. I think Monkey Grip's patchy, but it's lasted. It's still in print, David. It's amazing.
Oh, yes.
It's wonderful.
But was it really fiction? I mean, I've interviewed Helen recently for her new book, The Season.
Yeah.
And I put it to her that she's really Australia's best reporter.
Absolutely. I know. That's right. Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, it's, no.
And it was... We knew it was based on actual people and a diary that recorded all of this stuff. And the funny thing years later when it was being made into a film was that a whole lot of people who were outraged that they were in Helen's novel trekked to Sydney and offered themselves to be in the film. So, you know, Jarvo turned up and...
And it's still a wonderful book. Now, how many did it sell?
I think, I was trying to remember, I think it sold something like 4,000 in hardback, We only did it in hardback initially, which is the kind of natural order of things in those days. We did a lovely hardback with a pink band on the back and a photo of Helen on her bike.
I can see it in my mind's eye now. A photo still, from above.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Ponch Hawks took the photograph. It was fabulous. Helen in a flowery dress riding a bike. And then we did a paperback and we kept on printing it because it kept on selling.
Wonderful idea. Just keep on selling. On Late Night Live, my guest is Hilary McPhee, one of the two pioneering women publishers, Di Gribble being the other, who began the publishing house McPhee Gribble 50 years ago. So I take it, Hilary, that once the great success of Monkey Grip had established you as a fiction publisher, Monkey Grip and Thoroughly Decent People, but then I would imagine you would have been inundated with manuscripts.
We were. They arrived at the Fitzroy Post Office. By then we'd moved. No, they arrived at the Carlton Post Office. We'd moved to Carlton by that stage. We actually started the next stage, David. I just have to add this was, I discovered I was having my third baby, and Di was rung up by the adoption people and told that the baby that she and her husband had wanted to adopt was coming up in a month or something. So suddenly we had babies and everyone said, you have to go home, you've blown it. But we didn't. We found an old terrace in Carlton that was three-storey and had lots of spare rooms. It was very decrepit with a fire escape out the window and all that stuff. And we painted it and painted bits and pieces of it and rented rooms to other small publishers and had the children downstairs in a nursery with a childminder. And suddenly we had staff having babies that they didn't think they were going to have. And we ended up, I think, with five or six babies in the McPhee childcare department.
It was a house of legend. It's a house of legend. Now, you did employ some men. Now,
oh yes,
what kind of men did you employ?
Only men that made us laugh and were very original. You know, we didn't employ solemn men. We were doing all kinds of funny research by this stage, also practical puffins, and good ideas were needed for all kinds of books, like one called Strange Things. Body Tricks was another big one, which was about things that you did with your body. You'd remember these things
I remember that book.
You remember that book, and it had a finger in a matchbox, you know, the cut-off finger with blood all around the cut-off finger, and some gruesome things. But there were tricks that kids could do. And the Americans, by this time they were selling big time in America. Scholastic took them up, but they wouldn't take Body Tricks unless we made a change, and we refused to make a change.
What did they want taken out?
The Ouija board. We had a Ouija board in one called Strange Things, and they didn't like the title Body Tricks either. So a British bishop complained about the Ouija board, and somebody in America complained about the title, Scholastic, about the title Strange Things. It was too spooky, I think, for children. Children's publishing was very conservative then. This is early 80s, and it was still dull, really, and we livened it up a bit for a while.
Now when I have to read, well, very happily read stories to my great-nephews and nieces, they're all about bums and crime and violence, and this is for three-year-olds.
Yes, 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 yes. But they're issued with warnings, and parents are advised not to read them. And you know,
oh, for heaven's sake,
it's a much more nervous period now than the 1970s were. You know, we just thought kids were, if we treated them sensibly, they were sensible, and it was up to their parents to make sure they were. If they were sleeping outside looking at the night sky, they were warm enough. It wasn't our job.
Yeah, exactly. And then Kathy Lett turned up.
Yes, they turned up, Kathy and Gabriel Carey, with a guitar, of course, and came into our office and sang us a puberty blues song that they'd written to persuade us to take on their manuscript. And we, of course, fell big time for puberty blues, although it was shocking. There were terrible things in it about how to give your girlfriend an abortion. And we said, listen, this has got to be edited, and you can edit it in the office, but you have to show us and we will do it in one hit and this, you know, tell you whether you're getting away with it or not. And somebody in the office, I don't know, it might have been Dyer, just thought we'd ask Jermaine, who was in Cambridge at that stage, Jermaine Greer, to write us a cover line saying Puberty Blues was wonderful or whatever she wanted to say. So we sent it off to Jermaine, didn't hear a thing back. So we finally went ahead and published it without Jermaine. And years later, we got a letter from Jermaine recommending that we didn't publish. By then, we'd sold heaps.
What was Jermaine Greer's objections?
She thought it should have an anthropological expert framing it. It was a very academic response to it. It was very fascinating.
Oh, dear God.
That letter exists in the archive somewhere, but it was true.
And how many copies of Puberty Blues did you sell?
Oh, heaps. I don't remember, but it went on. It's still in print. Penguin have kept that in print too, as far as I know.
And, of course, you would have got a cut of the film, you would have the television series. Money must just have kept pouring in, Hilary.
No, we didn't get a cut of the film. That's not how it worked. No, we didn't. We just sold more copies because of the film. We did a film edition, you know, like people did in those days with a film cover.
But oh, yes.
We didn't get a cut of the film. Heavens, no.
Who was your agent?
I don't think we had an agent.
That was Dyer Gribble.
She
was business, wasn't she? Weren't you words and she was business?
Oh, that was sort of a crude. We were everything. We did everything together. We certainly, there was nothing that I did that I didn't get Dyer's approval and vice versa. You know, we were a partnership. That was the crucial thing, really.
The firm earned some nicknames. Can you recall any of them off the top of your head?
No. They were terrible nicknames.
But weren't they just a measure of how loved you were in the industry?
Well, that's what we like to think, yes.
Yes. McPhee, Gribble, Fuck Me and Grapple, wasn't
that? That was a terrible one we didn't know existed.
Ah.
We heard about that later, and that was kind of shocking.
Disappointed authors, I think.
Disappointed authors and furious men. There were men who were frightened to come to our office, we heard, on the grapevine. Barry Oakley was nervous about coming. I hope Barry's not listening. He's still going strong. But we were doing marvellous books. Tim Winton came to us because Allen and Unlam turned down a collection of short stories by Tim. They said, we don't do short stories.
Good move, Allen and Unlam.
We grabbed him and had him from then on. And when we were later acquired by Penguin, we had Cloud Street. We had wonderful Tim books, which are still out there.
I'll get to the Cloud Street issue a little bit later. Tell me, how did Australian publishing or the British publishers who called themselves Australian Publishing, how did they cope with you? Were they welcoming?
No, they weren't. It was dreadful going to London. We had the bright idea that we'd go to America first, where the American agents wanted to see us because they'd never met an Australian publisher before and they were interested in what we were doing and they were interested in Australia. So we'd go to New York first. It was usually me that did that, went around the agents and the publishers who couldn't wait to see us. They were marvellous. They'd say things like, oh, I reckon this conversation's worth a page of my, what were those diaries called that you had to pay for by the page? I can't remember. Anyway, and then we'd go on to London where no one wanted to see us because we were really in the way as an Australian publisher. They wanted to deal direct with Australian authors and not have us with Australian and US rights. So that was our clever thing, really, that we went round the world a different way. But it meant that in London we suffered. Nobody rang us back. No, very few people took us out. Carmen Carlile was a dear friend at Virago and she was very supportive and bought books from us. She bought Monkey Grip. And This Bared My Center, a wonderful book by a woman who was in a nursing home who got the message to us that she wanted to, she'd written a book and we got her to show us. And it was a diary of being in a nursing home called This Bed, My Centre, and that sold really well in Australia. No one had done such a book, and Virago sold it really well in the UK. So we were doing good things. We had very interesting books, but the British publishers punished us. They didn't want us.
Did you cut a path for other independent publishers at this time? I mean, were the people who saw what you were doing and making such a splash and follow?
Look, there were other feminist publishers then, and we didn't describe ourselves as feminist publishers, but the Women's Press was up and running in London, and they had, I think, a couple of people in Australia. So feminist publishing by the early 80s was around. But small publishers have a very hard time making a living out of it, and none of them lasted very long, nor did we, sadly.
Well, why with all of this acclaim and success and the extraordinary degree to which you were, you know, bringing new writers to the Australian readers, why did this not translate into prosperity for you?
Because we were trying to... Look, I'll go back a step. Brian Johns, the wonderful Brian Johns, came to Penguin. He wanted to be a publisher before he became a broadcaster. He came to Penguin in the early 83, I think, something like that, and became publishing director. And he hot-footed it to our office almost as soon as he arrived because he'd heard about us. And we just became great friends. And every Friday we'd meet and he'd talk his ideas, we'd talk our ideas. We were a kind of partnership without an agreement in a way. And Penguin was selling our books and they were doing well for them. But when Brian left to take up the SBS job, there was a huge party in Melbourne and Di and I were at it dancing the night away, but we knew in our bones that everything was going to change at Penguin because there was a new, much more conservative English managing director that had come out who thought that what we were doing was, that our terms were too agreeable, I think, that Brian had organised a reasonable rate for us and that we should be being squeezed a bit. And they then proceeded to squeeze us. And we decided we'd buy ourselves out and go into partnership with Carmen or with someone else. I mean, we had big ideas. And the squeeze hit just as Keating's recession we had to have hit in 87, 89. Interest rates for borrowing went as high as 17%.
Yeah.
Someone even offered us 21% to do a list of pornography. And, you know, it was just nobody understood publishing and we were caught in this awful, awful net, really. And we realised in the end we had nowhere to go but to Penguin. So,
but there is a rumour. These stories abound in the publishing world. There is a rumour that at the time you were facing, this financial squeeze, you had not yet published Cloud Street. And if you had published Cloud Street, might it all have been different?
Yes, it would have been different because Cloud Street was a huge success. But it wouldn't have been different enough. We've employed 12 people at this stage and we were in a lovely, shabby office in Fitzroy. And we were, I suppose, a bit big for our boots. We once had a staff meeting at a weekend trying to persuade the staff that our standards were too high.
What?
Because there was not editorial standards, but publishing, you know, production standards. People would work all night to get rid of things that they'd spotted or woken up thinking about. And our books were kind of perfect little paperbacks. They were far too perfect. And I remember Dyer trying to say, look, we could just bring out books that were 70%, not 90%. And everybody looked white with horror and went on doing what they did.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct.
But anyway, that was the end of things. So we were swallowed up.
And when you were swallowed up, the two of you, Dyer went one way, you went another.
It was terrible. That was the terrible thing. Because Penguin only wanted me because they thought if I was there, the authors would stay. And that was such a stupid thing because if they had both of us, a whole lot of other authors would have stayed. Dyer brought in people like Ignatius Jones, for goodness sake, and Red Simons and all kinds of funny, popular people. And I was bringing in literature and ideas, books, and, you know, they needed both of us. But they only wanted one of us. They only wanted me. And I had to go out to Penguin and save a few jobs. I saved four or five jobs by persuading Peter Field, who was running the place at the time, that I couldn't do everything. You know, they just thought they'd roll us into Penguin and that would be the end of us.
So there you were, nearly 15 years, and the great example of what independent publishing can do in this country. Now all the way down the track, what does independent publishing in this country look like to you?
Look, it's like it's gone full circle in a way. I mean, I must admit I don't spend a great deal of time gazing at it, but I do look at what's coming out. And the English are still dominating our market, but the Americans are getting bigger too. And the Americans own a lot of the English international companies now. So multinational publishing is more alive than it ever was. It's huge, absolutely huge. And AI is going to change all that again. I mean, there'll be need for fewer editors. Editors will go on being required, but an awful lot of those jobs can be done initially by AI and then fixed up by a good editor, perhaps. I don't know. I worry about it.
Well, yes. But, you know, the wonderful thing, Hilary, is that the problems of AI are really going to have to be dealt with by people much younger than us.
That's right.
Much, much younger than us, yes.
That's right, yes. Exactly.
Tell me, before you go, what is the most exciting book you've ever edited?
Oh, God. Oh, I think I would have... Look, there were so many, but I think I would have to say Cloud Street. The Children's Bark is another, which I adore. It's the only book of real fiction that Helen wrote, I think. It's a wonderful book. That's still in print. I mean, a lot of these books are still in print. But Cloud Street, I reread Cloud Street every few years, wondering if it's going to stand up, wondering whether it's now too old-fashioned or something, but it's not. It's marvellous. It's a marvellous book.
Perhaps, Hilary, that is the greatest testament to McPhee Gribble of 50 years ago. Your books are still in print.
Yes, that pleases me mightily. Pleases me mightily. But I'd love to see the Practical Puffins back in print, but not as puffins.
Hilary, congratulations. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live. Hilary McPhee, one of the founders of McPhee Gribble, legendary firm in the Australian publishing and reading world. Thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.